People Have the Power, Patti Smith. You're listening to WZRD Chicago. On the line is Larry Shoup, historian, PhD at Northwestern University in history. His most recent book on the governing class of the United States and actually the world, titled Wall Street's Think Tank, the Council on Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics, 1976 to 2014. Sounds dry, but he writes with a clarity that I found fascinating, trying to understand why it is we've arrived at this point where in the history of the human species, economics and personal wealth, private property, are in a position to place the future of mankind at risk. You've done a number of interviews about this book, and all of them failed to go beyond Chapter 7, in which you laid out the structure and how the power is exercised of the Council on Foreign Relations. Can you talk, Larry, about where the Council on Foreign Relations' private club originates from, its intent, and then we'll get into your most recent book with a short stop on the way. Thanks for being on WZRD Chicago. We're supposed to be anonymous. This is a collective. You're Lawrence Shoup, historian. I'm just a wizard, a part of a collective. And I think that's something you'd appreciate.
Thank you for that introduction. So the history of this organization starts in the First World War period at the Paris Versailles Peace Conference. And that's where the British and the U.S. Strategic planners got together and decided to form an organization with a branch in England and a branch in the United States. And the United States branch merged with another organization, which was a businessmen's organization called the Council on Foreign Relations, which was oriented towards increasing trade and investment internationally for the United States. And that became the Council on Foreign Relations, founded in 1921. And they also had a magazine, Foreign Affairs magazine, that started in 1922, which is still a very prominent, important magazine worldwide. So it dates back to a long time, and it's unique in the sense that it's both a think tank and a large-scale membership organization. Usually things are either one or the other. They're either the NAACP, a membership organization, or the American Enterprise Institute, a think tank. Well, the council is both. It has 5,000 members, in fact. It's a very large membership organization. It also has corporate members. The individual members are just individuals. They have corporate members, and the individuals have to be U.S. citizens. The corporate ones can be international, so Deutsche Bank or, you know, the ENI, the Italian multinational oil company. They're corporate members of the Council on Foreign Relations. And the council does grand strategic planning through its think tank, and they try to control the thinking behind U.S. foreign policy and even domestic policy. And this, its history shows that it's the most powerful private organization, I believe, in world history. And it's still very powerful, even though its power is somewhat diminished under Trump, who represents a different faction of the capitalist class. So compared to previous administrations, the council representation in the Trump administration is much less. But given that still the National Security Advisor and a lot of other people in the Trump administration are Council on Foreign Relations members, and the corporate side of it, that is the Tillerson, for example, the Secretary of State. Usually the Secretary of State is a council member. Tillerson, the current Secretary of State, is not, but ExxonMobil is a corporate member of the council, and that's what he comes from, of course, ExxonMobil. It's a capitalist class-dominated organization, the council. The Rockefellers have been very prominent, but also other plutocratic families like the Vanderbilt, the Mellon, the DuPonts, et cetera, have been prominent in the council, but they have a very important assist from the what I call the professional class, that is, educated people, professionals, usually from Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Columbia, Johns Hopkins, the University of Chicago, Stanford. Those are the main universities that the council people draw on for expertise, and there's a lot of council members that are professors at those universities. The professional class, of course, also includes journalists, lawyers, nonprofit leaders, etc. Internationally, they're tied to the Bilderbergers and the Trilateral Commission, the Group of 30. It's an international capitalist class. They're the Davos crowd in the U.S. The U.S. representatives at Davos are mostly Council on Foreign Relations people. Globalism is their mantra, which explains a little bit about why the Trump crowd is not quite the same. They produce thousands of productions of various types of things, books, articles, reports, blogs, op-ed pieces, testimony before Congress, interviews on the television. Oftentimes, when they do those things, they don't identify themselves as members of the Council on Foreign Relations. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. I've been following the Council on Foreign Relations for almost 50 years and have written 3 books on the Council on Foreign Relations and related topics. And as you mentioned, the latest one is Wall Street's Think Tank. So this organization is very worthwhile following. My book is extensive, of course. It requires some effort to read it because it's long and has hundreds and hundreds of footnotes, almost 800 footnotes. So it does require an effort, but the reward, I think, is great because, like you kindly said, it's well written. It's pretty easy to read, even though it takes an effort to do so.
So can you mention how, as a graduate student, you were sort of looking for a topic and thumbing through the stacks at the library at Northwestern?
I was in the late 60s. I was looking for my dissertation topic, and I used to like to go up and down the stacks at Northwestern where I was a graduate student, and I saw something that said the War and Peace Studies, and there were all these volumes, maybe I think it was 50 or 60 volumes of the War and Peace Studies. Well, that sounded kind of interesting because I was interested in foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy. So I started looking at these, and these were the strategic planning documents of the Council on Foreign Relations during World War II, before the United States got involved in World War II, and in World War II. And the story is really interesting that came out. The war started, of course, on September 1st, 1939, when Hitler invaded Poland. On September 12th, that is 12 days after the war started in Europe, and only a few days after Britain had declared war on Germany, leaders of the council were meeting with an assistant secretary of state saying we should be planning for the post-war world order. This gives you an idea of the scope of the council. They're very advanced planners. So the war had just broken out in Europe. The United States was still over 2 years before the United States even got in the war. And the council was talking to the State Department saying we better start planning for the post-war world order after the war. Indeed, the State Department was interested. They said, yes, why don't you start some planning, and you can give us documents. So they got a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation and set up something called the War Peace Studies, which brought together intellectuals from many different universities, Harvard and Yale among them, but others as well. University of Chicago actually was one of them that did have representation on the War Peace Studies planning. And they started planning for the post-war world order. And this, of course, led to some documents in the 1940-41, which said that the Southeast Asia area, including Vietnam, but also other Southeast Asian countries, was a complementary area to the U.S. economy. The U.S. economy was based on raw material imports and industrial and farm product exports. And so this area was a very important complementary area that should not be allowed to fall under the domain or the control of a hostile power, namely Japan in this case. And so they developed something they called the Grand Area. And the Grand Area was the minimum living space for the U.S. economy. It included Southeast Asia. So they said if Japan crosses that line, we need to go to war with Japan to stop them from taking over Southeast Asia on a long-term basis because that area is very important. This, of course, continued later on and became the basis for U.S. policy in Vietnam, which is kind of beyond probably our scope today, but it's very interesting that this dates back all the way to the early part of the Second World War. So anyway, looking at the War Peace Studies, I began to look at these documents. I said, this is a very interesting topic that's never been covered in a dissertation, and so I decided to do my dissertation on the Council on Foreign Relations and its war peace studies in World War II, and it was called Shaping the National Interest, the Council on Foreign Relations and the New World Order. That was my PhD dissertation from Northwestern.
This is finished in
1974, I guess.
This is WZRD Chicago. We're talking with Larry Shoup, a historian, about his most recent book, Wall Street's Think Tank, The Council on Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics, 1976-2014. Before we get into Chapter 8, Fiddling While the Earth Slowly Burns, The Council and the Ecological Crisis, 1990-2014, one of the reports that you came across was a study that called for the U.S. government to embargo steel and petroleum to the Japanese. It's my understanding that that's why the Japanese attacked the United States.
Yeah, that is. But the Japanese, of course, were creating their own world order in East Asia.
And that was seen as a threat. That was seen as a threat.
And so they were planning to go towards Southeast Asia, and the United States could see that. They were already massing troops and getting ready to go into Southeast Asia. The U.S. could see that. So it decided, and the Council recommended these policies. I should back up and say that Council came up with all these memos, which were the war peace studies. These are hundreds, I think it was 600 and some memos. These memos were sent to the U.S. government. They were on President Roosevelt's desk, among others. Of course, they were sent to the State Department, the War Department, etc. And these memos were, one of them did recommend this embargo of Japan because Japan was threatening areas that were part of what the Council saw as the grand area, that is the minimum living space for the U.S. economy. So since the Japanese were threatening that, they decided we'll put an end to that by cutting off their oil and their raw material imports to the extent that we can. So they did that, and of course Japan then simultaneously attacked the U.S. at Pearl Harbor, but at the same time their troop ships, which they had been preparing for a while, were headed for Southeast Asia and Vietnam to take over that area for the Greater East Area Co-Prosperity Sphere, which was the Japanese equivalent of the Grand Area.
Right.
And, of course, Germany had their living space theory as well, which included the USSR. And that's why Hitler attacked the USSR in June of 1941, a fateful event, of course, in world history. The Titanic battles that are still the greatest battles in world history took place in Eastern Europe between the Nazis and the Soviets won.
The U.S. Governing class, and many people understand the U.S. government to be the executive of the capitalist class, had no problems with Japanese imperialism repressing the Koreans and in Manchuria, the Chinese. That was fine with them. It was only when they saw their threats to their economic prosperity of U.S. corporations that they then perturbed Japan into attacking. And it was the alliance between Japan and Germany that brought the U.S. into war with the Germans, because there was tremendous opposition in this country to being involved in the Second World
War. That's right. Hitler declared war on the United States after the United States declared war on Japan.
Okay.
Part of their alliance between Japan and Hitler. So, I wouldn't characterize the United States as not caring whether or not Korea and China, they weren't willing to go to war to defend Korea and China, whereas they were willing to go to war to stop the Japanese from taking over Southeast Asia, which was seen as a more complementary area and part of the grand area.
And all through this is the role of petroleum, oil, and energy, and the significance that plays in modern industrial economies, but especially in advancing and protecting the markets of those economies through a military that runs on oil and not coal.
The greatest consumer of oil and fossil fuels is the U.S. military. probably the greatest consumer in world history, but also the greatest contemporary consumer right. of oil and gas. So this time, you know, in this earlier period, recent times, I should back up and say recent times, the fracking has made the U.S. oil power much more than it has been in the last 10, 15 years. Of course, earlier in history, the U.S. was a tremendous oil power, but then the decline of the oil fields made the U.S. interested in taking over other oil fields, like, you know, controlling other oil fields, like the Iraq oil fields. And so the United States did invade that country for that reason, in my view, and that's part of my book, Wall Street's Think Tank. The Iraq War is a very important event in 21st century history, and the United States invasion of Iraq was organized and planned by the CFR and people in and out of the government, in the CFR, planning outside the government, and then CFR people in the government, because they go in and out. They're inners and outers, as it said. That is, they have a private life as a professor or as a capitalist leader of a corporation, and then they go into the government, and then they come back out and go back into the private enterprise.
Okay.
They're inners and outers.
So in Chapter 8, titled Fiddling While the Earth Slowly Burns, The Council and the Ecological Crisis, 1990 to 2014, that's about 25 years, actually longer now since the book has come out. The council started studying the issue of climate change and its effect on their business model and their business practices. And you point out in the book that the most significant members of the council happen to be the dominant energy companies on the planet and company corporations related to that activity. Can you talk about their first involvement and the role that the significant, in my reading, role that
Robert Heilbrunner.
Yeah, the economic historian played in his analysis, his contribution to the report, along with Roger Stone, both of whom had very serious comments on where the future was going if the council didn't change the business practices that it was tied to.
Yeah. Well, first we should mention the global ecological crisis is a central contradiction of our time. It is underplayed in the mass media and underplayed everywhere, and it's threatening our human species. If we destroy our biosphere and our oceans, we're going to have any air to breathe, and we're going to run out of food because there's going to be too much heat. The crops won't grow. It's so serious, and yet it's so underplayed. You see the weather report, and they talk about, we're getting really hot temperatures here, breaking all the records, and these floods and droughts, and they never put it in context. So that's because the climate of opinion has been shaped by organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations, including the Council on Foreign Relations. So they don't really get at the meat of what they don't want to deal with it even as a holistic situation. That is the ecological crisis. They just want to talk about one aspect, climate change. That's only one part of the ecological crisis. It's much larger. So the council began to think about this in 1990. So their book, Sea Changes, came out, and of course the main part of the book was talking about the changes in the world situation because of the collapse of the Soviet bloc. But they did have two articles, as you mentioned, one by Robert Heilbrunner, the other by Roger Stone. And Heilbrunner, both of them, of course, are CFR people. Stone was a CFR staff, and Heilbrunner had been a member for a while, at least. I'm not sure if he was still a member at that time. I forget now, but he had been a member. And he pointed out, Heilbrunner's key quote was, he pointed out, quote, the looming confrontation of capitalist dynamics with the limits of ecological tolerance. Now, what he means by capitalist dynamics is that capitalism is a expand-or-die system. It has to grow. And That, of course, contradicts with the fact we live on a finite planet that doesn't have endless amounts of resources. It doesn't have endless forests. If they're cut down, that creates a problem because forests absorb carbon. You can't plow up the ground forever because that releases carbon. You have to go to no-till agroecological agriculture in order to save the planet. There's a lot of things implied in the looming confrontation of capitalist dynamics with the limits of ecological tolerance, because our ecologies, you can't keep pouring pollution and poisons and chemicals and into the ocean. You can't keep heating the atmosphere, or we're going to end up like Venus, where you can melt lead on the surface of Venus. That's where we're headed. Obviously, that's not happening immediately, but we need to be alarmist because the situation is alarming. We're talking about only a few decades that we have to try to turn this around, or global warming is going to get out of control, just one aspect of this. And he went on and said that this carbon emissions, heating the earth, massive reductions are needed, but that threatens the capitalist socioeconomic order. And so as long as capitalists are in charge with their short-term horizons, they're only interested in the next cycle of profits, that is going to destroy the planet that we need to survive as a human species and other life forms as well. We have to look at nature, of course, for its own sake, valued for its own sake, but it's also valuable for us because we need the planet to live on. The political will, as Heidelberger pointed out, was the problem. There was not enough political will to make the changes needed. Government intervention was required. The market role has to be reduced very sharply, and it has to be done worldwide, but especially in developed Western nations and China increasingly, which is the source of the problem. So if you don't have government intervention and you have neoliberalism, which is what we've got, stressing the market, stressing privatization, and at the extreme, we have climate denial, which I think the council led to with their ultimate conclusions, which we'll get to in some of their other studies. Their ultimate conclusions was we really can't do anything about this within the framework of capitalism. We want to keep capitalism. Therefore, we can't do anything about it. This leads to a denial stance, which is what we have in the current Trump administration. So that was what Heidelberger laid out way back in 1990. That's 28 years ago now. So
subsequently, they've had some other reports, but about the same time you get Milton Friedman pushing the notion of rational man and free markets and everybody grab for themselves what they can, and somehow if everybody acts like a monster towards their fellow human beings, everyone will somehow benefit.
That's a bankrupt idea, of course.
Of course it is, from the beginning. It was validated in part by creating a Nobel Award in honor of Alfred Nobel, and its effect was to create the illusion that neoliberal economics was hard science, so much so that the scientists whose work is often filtered through the economists at the IPPC, who eventually write or put together what can be told to the politicians and the public, they say, according to the glaciologist Robert Alley, the economists have discount the future, i.e. no value in the future, and to shorten what they believe, money can solve all problems, and people will be richer because there'll always be growth in the future.
Yeah. That's
totally absurd.
Absurd idea. If we're all dead, we're not richer, obviously, and that's where we're headed. So some people might call me an alarmist, but we need to be alarmed at what's going on.
When there's a fire on and you pull the alarm.
Something about it. Anyway, Stone was the other guy that talked about, he mentioned massive deforestation and water pollution and industrial disasters like the one in India at Bhopal, which killed thousands of people. Those things amount to human misuse of the Earth's resources and had to be changed. So in 1990, the council was put on notice by council people. And some council people, you know, there's 5,000 members, individual members in the Council on Foreign Relations. So there's a diversity, and some of them are pretty wise people. They don't necessarily dominate the organization, which is dominated by the big capitalists. David Rockefeller was the chairman of the council for many years, a billionaire. Another billionaire, Peter Peterson, was chairman of the council after David Rockefeller. He was a private equity guy. You know, private equities, what they do is they buy up companies, make them, quote, more efficient by laying off a bunch of people, and then resell them or sell parts of them and make a lot of money that way. Peterson was the chair after that, and now the chair is David Rubenstein, who's the head of Carlyle, which is another private equity. He's a billionaire, too. So the top people at the council, in general, there's a few exceptions, but the top people have all been these big capitalists. They're the ones that guide the organization. So you may have dissent at the lower levels, and there's examples of that within the council. And so some of these people have said to the council, we should be changing this. But the dominant view of the council, it's corporate-dominated, it's capitalist-dominated, and capitalism is the problem. And that's what hasn't been talked about in the mass media, hasn't been talked about much in the universities. They purged most of the Marxist historians and so on. I used to teach in the university. I was purged out of the university myself. I know what happens. I know other friends who were Marxist-oriented or revolutionary-oriented or radicals or critics just get kicked out of the university. They don't get rehired or they're actually fired. Joel Covell, a very brilliant man, wrote a number of books on ecological things. He was teaching at a university in New York, and he was kicked out because he wrote a critical study of the Israeli taking over of so much Palestinian land. He wrote that, so then they fired him, and they hired a former Council on Foreign Relations person that was a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. They hired him to take Joel Covell's place. So this happens all the time. We're getting weaker and weaker in terms of left critiques of this kind of thing, which is very detrimental to our society and our ability of young people to see the light, to see the truth.
Well, I think they're seeing the truth. They they don't have the center that they had to move towards when Socialist Party or the Communist Party played a dominant role in this society, which was a threat to the capitalist model.
Yeah.
But they are organizing under environmental movements and whatnot. Perhaps you saw the webcast of Fossil Free Fast that 350.org put together, and it reminded me of some of the things that you address following the end of Chapter 8, where you talk about possibilities, eco-socialism, and the ability to have a future we can believe in. And but we'll get to that. So,
yeah, it is. There are a lot of encouraging things going on, that's for sure. But we certainly need to increase the ante and struggle harder, because it's not going fast enough, the changes that we need. Anyway, go ahead.
So, and that's exactly what McKibben and others were saying, that carbon taxes and or cap and trade, or believing in global warming, that was not enough to expect from your elected officials. The people who can manipulate the levers of government to actually put corporations in their place, which is why the corporations have been working to undermine government's power and take over those levers to advance their interests. Alex Carey, maybe you know his work, Taking the Risk Out of Democracy, writes about the American business model, which goes back prior to the Powell memo that's currently being talked about.
Even back past then, that's the 70s, yeah.
That's right.
Mid-70s, yeah.
So can you talk about, they start with Hill Brunner, and they get the warning, and then there's a 10-year hiatus, and then they start as the issue is heating up, and there's more demonstration, more calls for addressing climate change, more threats to corporate power, and actually students graduating from the universities refusing to work out of moral principles for oil companies. Not enough, apparently, but people
but
make...
But some. It's inspiring to see how many people are getting active, even though we lament that it's not as big as it should be. There's resistance movements all over, and revolutionary movements that say we have to get overthrow capitalism, or we're going to the human species is at risk. So that was the first Victor. David Victor was hired by the council in 1998 to do a study group, and it was called the first Victor study group. And it had a technological focus. It wasn't interested, of course, in transforming capitalism because it's the Council on Foreign Relations. But the chair for the group was interesting. It was Rodney W. Nichols. He was a consultant for Shell Technical Ventures. So he was searching for new technology at the same time he was in this council, leading this council study group with David Victor. And, of course, that's a problem because they were looking for complementary efforts to Shell's, to help Shell's profit. The focus ended up, for that study group, ended up on the Kyoto Protocol and why the Kyoto Protocol wouldn't work, and concluded finally that taxes and emission trading was the real solution that you could come up with to stop climate change. Again, they were focused only on one aspect of the ecological crisis, which is includes the oceans, it includes things like aerosol loading and other things. There's a number of aspects to the ecological crisis, the most important of which, of course, is climate change, and the second one being the ocean's acidification and the loss of oxygen in the ocean and the pollution of the ocean. But anyway, they said that these emission trading, the cap and trade, that was the first time that the council concluded that cap and trading was a solution. But they didn't really make a big effort to try to get it until later. So there was a second Victor study group, which laid out the range of options. Now, all these study groups, as I mentioned, this Rodney W. Nichols was a consultant. He was the chair of the advisory council for the study group. They have an advisory council. And he worked for Shell Oil. He was a consultant for Shell Oil. So this illustrates what the council was doing. The council, of course, is dominated by big capitalists from finance capital and from fossil capital. ExxonMobil, British Petroleum, Shell, what's that other one?
Chevron, Unocal.
Chevron. They're all big in the council. The council has this corporate membership, and at the top level are these big oil corporations and the big, the big finance like Goldman Sachs and Chase, J.P. Morgan Chase, etc., are the top level of the corporate advisors. So they have these people in, these type of people, representatives from ExxonMobil and British Petroleum in these study groups, which are usually, 15 to 20, maybe 25 people, representing different interests, and some of them intellectuals, some of them from corporations, top people, or people that are representing these corporations. So because they couldn't come to much of a consensus, the second Victor study group was one that set out the range of options. And these options, of course, are always within the framework of capitalism. They're always market-based options that don't go beyond what was called by the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, Richard Haass, a highly divisive question. So there was a lot of disagreement, so they came up with a range of options. And these included emission trading, these included doing nothing, of course, but they didn't include we have to change capitalism, which is based on the endless trading of commodities, production and trading of commodities around the world with big ships taking all these commodities back and forth between China and the U.S., etc., burning very highly polluting Bunker C crude oil on the way, all these... nature of the of the capitalist system, these things weren't mentioned in the study groups. These weren't brought up as possible things that you could change. It was always within the market based options, which eventually led to the last of these study groups, an independent task force. And I should mention what an independent task force is, because the Council on Foreign Relations pretends in its publications that it's not a policy-making organization. It just explores different possibilities. Now, of course, that's not true. They're always advocating. Their people are going into government, and then they're making policy. The current national security advisor for Trump is H.R. McMaster. He's been a Council on Foreign Relations member for decades. He's a general. They have generals in the Council on Foreign Relations and admirals that are leaders of the Council on Foreign Relations as well. So he is advising right now President Trump on foreign policy. The key advisor for the President Trump is a Council on Foreign Relations member. So even though they're somewhat less represented than previous administrations, where they were completely dominant, now they're struggling for control in the Trump administration. But anyway, they go in and out of government. They're making policy in the government, and then they're recommending policy when they're out of government. But they wanted to have a stronger recommendation, so they decided that was that would be clearer. They decided to set up something called the Independent Task Force. And what the council does is decides on a topic, then it chooses who's in the task force, and then it says, okay, that's as far as we're going to go. We're not going to recommend policy because the council doesn't recommend policy, even though they do behind the scenes. But this case, we're going to recommend policy, but it's going to be independent of the council. So we're going to call it an independent task force. So they had this independent task force number 61. And by the way, I should mention that if people are more interested in getting some of these documents, or would like to get some of these documents, the Council on Foreign Relations website, CFR.org, there you can get the annual report of the Council on Foreign Relations and look at the membership list. You can look at who's the director of the Council on Foreign Relations. You can look at various interviews that they've had with people, presentations at the council, and you can find these various task force reports. This is number 61. So, you know, there were 60 before this one, and there's been many since then. Currently, they just had one on Korea, what to do about Korea. And what was very interesting about this Korea study group was that they recommended a very harsh policy towards North Korea, right in line with what Trump is doing. So even though Trump doesn't have as many Council on Foreign Relations people as, say, Clinton did or Obama did or Bush did, they still are following a lot of Council on Foreign Relations policies. And so this independent task force recommended a cap and trade as the policy of the United States. They were setting the agenda and the grand strategy for U.S. domestic and foreign policy on climate change. And this David Victor, who had been in these other study groups, led this group. He was a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Another guy named Levi was involved as a co-head of the study group. And they also had people like Lawrence Summers and George Pataki, who was the governor of New York, David Rubenstein, who's currently the chair of the Council on Foreign Relations. So these people were on the advisory council. So it was very top-flight independent task force. People who had been in the government as top leaders in the government were on this task force. And they were able to get the House of Representatives to pass this. In June 2009, they passed a cap-and-trade in the House of Representatives. Now, this cap-and-trade, of course, is a weak system that you're supposed to give permits to various entities to pollute, that is corporations, so they can pollute, and then cut the permit, they have to pay for the permit, and then cut the permits down, the amount that they can pollute, down to a lower level each year. Of course, it's very slow, number one. Number two, it's characterized by cheating. They have one in Europe that's characterized by cheating. They have one here in California that's characterized by cheating. So it stays within the market. It's all market-based. It doesn't really put any very serious limits on that, on the cap-and-trade. It failed, though, in the Senate. It passed in the House. It was going to be law of the land if Obama could sign it, and he would have signed it, and I believe. But it failed in the Senate because the Republicans were totally opposed, and five oil corporations that were all corporate members of the Council on Foreign Relations, this was ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, Chevron, British Petroleum, and Shell Oil, these five oil corporations, even though they'd been involved in the planning, they were obviously didn't agree with it. It was against their short-term interest. They lobbied against it, and they were able to get the Senate to vote it down. So even that weak cap-and-trade system was voted down as a result of these oil companies lobbying, which are corporate members of the Council on Foreign Relations. So the Council didn't have unanimous consent. And that's another aspect of the Council, is they're trying to bring together the capitalists who tend to sometimes compete. It's monopoly capitalism, but there are some competitive features. They tend to compete, so sometimes the corporations might be in conflict with each other. So the Council's purpose, one of their goals, is to bring the capitalist class into consensus. And they failed on this particular case, and they did not get the cap-and-trade passed. So then Richard Haass, the president of the Council, and Richard Haass is an intellectual. The Council, of course, is an organization where people who want to become part of the capitalist class, which I define as those people, the 1%, or those people who have enough assets to live on without going to work. They don't have to get up in the morning and say, gee, it's 5 o'clock in the morning, I better get to my job. No, if you're a capitalist, you can lay in bed all day, and the money pours in like an avalanche because you own a lot of stuff. So that's the capitalist class. They want to get in the capitalist class, a lot of people. So if they can join the Council on Foreign Relations, and of course you have to be approved by the Council to join, you can apply, but doesn't mean you'll get in, because many more apply than are allowed to get in. If you get in, you can meet into capitalists. You meet capitalists, and then you have a chance to get things. So Richard Haass is an example of that. He didn't start out as a capitalist. He started out as an intellectual. He became president of the Council on Foreign Relations from the State Department. He was the head of the policy planning for the State Department getting into the Iraq War. Of course, he was a member of the Council. He'd worked for the Council. He'd been a senior fellow in the previous, and then he became the president of the Council. Well, he wrote in 2013, he wrote a book called Foreign Policy Begins at Home. And he stressed in that low growth, which would be the result if you didn't have fossil fuels, you'd have lower growth probably. And so prolonged low growth, he said, could cause potentially dire consequences to the United States. The low mobility would result, and there would be rising class frictions. Now, this, of course, is the thing that the capitalist class fears, and is why they don't even want to talk about class. So if you watch the television, they don't talk about class very much. They talk about race and gender, areas where there can be division among the working class and its potential allies in the professional class. I use kind of a three-class model: capitalist class, professional class, working class. Middle class is a useless term in my view. Anyway, that we can go on a little bit more about that if you want. But anyway, Haass thought class frictions would come up, and if you didn't have a lot of growth. So you need to have this oil, and therefore we can't really do anything about global warming. We're not going to try. And that's been the Council ever since. They have not had another study group on the ecological crisis or the climate problem of global warming, or on the oceans. They don't have anything on that. They're paralyzed by their class interest and outlook, which is short-term, unplanned, solidarity among the capitalists, and the result is the status quo. Instead of what we need is a crash program in renewables. We need to end all the capitalist expansionism. We need to stop subsidies. These are kind of transitional forms. But we still have massive subsidies. In 2012, there was $544 billion in subsidies for fossil fuels in that year worldwide, $544 billion.
Right. Most of it going to petroleum, according to complainers over at the coal industry.
Yeah, that's right. It's interesting that coal's not represented very well in the Council on Foreign Relations at all. Oil is very highly represented.
Well, Rockefeller is a prime mover of that organization,
right.
And so is the military, actually. But you mentioned... You mentioned the lack of class unity. There is a market conflict in technological application. We already have technologies that could radically reduce the use of petroleum in transportation and energy production, and those are being sabotaged to the extent they can be by the oil interests. Can you speak to that then? The way that someone like Elon Musk, definitely a capitalist, and people who support him, and the solar energy producers and scientists who are researching ways of capturing energy from the sun and making it generally available, the way that their model, still capitalist, but it destroys the monopoly aspect that currently dominates the energy production system.
Yeah. Yeah, usually when you have new technologies, the government gives a boost to it. The internet, was developed by the government, by the military. Then they turn it over to the private interests, which is not wise. I think we should have a government side of this, all this that the government controls. So we used to have fairly serious subsidies for solar, and I myself put solar panels on my house, put water and electricity, because there was some good subsidies that you could rely on. Otherwise, it cost $30,000 as it was, and it would have been more if I hadn't had the subsidies from the government, some tax breaks and so on. So they're taking those away now. So that's an example of the role of big oil in the government, taking away and still allowing or still giving way beyond what's necessary. I mean, there isn't any subsidies necessary for oil and fossil fuels. They should be cutting them all, and they should be limiting the amount of use of fossil fuels by government fiat. It has to happen, or we're going to destroy the planet, the biosphere.
Government fiat means an end to the market-based, private property-based system.
Yes, that's right. We have to get, unfortunately, I mean, fortunately or unfortunately, I think we could get community based economics rather than private-based economics. But this country we live in is very oriented towards private property. And this is destructive of the planet, and it's destructive of human relationships, too, because we have this inequality that's unbelievably vast. The amount of money that these billionaires have is beyond comprehension. If you're talking about some of these billionaires are, in the area of 50, 60, 70 billion. That's thousands of millions. And, of course, we have families that are over 200 billion. That's 200,000 million. You can't even comprehend that much. And then here we have half the population that's living paycheck to paycheck. So this inequality has to be changed, and that's going to be what we have to have. We have to have a movement that says we can't have this inequality and we can't have capitalism run amok because it's destroying the livelihood and the future of all of us. And I have two grandkids. They're 3 and 4 years old. One's almost 5. This is going to be horrendous for them. We're just seeing the beginning with these massive wildfires, with these tremendous floods like in Houston, with these hurricanes like devastated Puerto Rico. We're just seeing the beginnings of what's going to happen to our planet and our humanity if we allow this capitalism to keep running amok on our planet. It's not easy to think about changing this very powerful system, but if we want to survive as a species and as individuals and as people we love, we're going to have to do something about it. I think I'd want to give a quote. I think we're towards the end of this talk.
Well, we've got another 10 minutes or so.
Oh, we do.
Yeah.
Let me give this quote, though, because I think it's a good one. Margaret Mead once said, quote, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has."
Right.
The only thing that's changed the world is a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens. Well, we have a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens now. We need to spread it through neighborhood councils, neighborhood assemblies, talking to your neighbors about this problem, getting them united on the need to overthrow this destructive system that we've got. And that's what I'm about. And that's what it sounds like you're about, and so that we need to be working on that.
So you end Chapter 8 with this lead-up to Chapter 9, which presents a case for a different, fully democratic system, a new civilization that could successfully preserve nature and affirm all forms of life. And you offer some reflections on capitalist class rule versus democracy and the public interest. I'm wondering if you know who Norman Bethune is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've heard of him.
Yeah. So
yeah,
frontline surgeon, wondered if the wars that he was fixing the wounds in were really started for the high-minded causes that were fed to the public, or if it was really about protecting the profits of this capitalist class we've been talking about. And he wondered what they looked like. And this from the work of Stephen Gowans, who blogs at What's Left. He says, quoting Stephen Gowans, "Bethune denounced as an enemy of the human race the very same class which rules in Washington. In his view, in its hunt for profits, the class starts the wars which create the wounds," which he was and all frontline surgeons are called upon to heal. What do the members of this class, these enemies of humanity, look like, he wondered. Quote, "Do they wear on their heads a sign so they may be told, shunned, and condemned as criminals? No, on the contrary, they are the respectable ones. They are honored. They call themselves and are called gentlemen. They are the pillars of the state, of the church, of society. They support private and public charity out of the excess of their wealth. They endow institutions. In their private lives, they are kind and considerate. But there is one sign by which these gentlemen can be told. Threaten a reduction in their profits, and the beast in them awakens with a snarl. They become ruthless as savages, brutal as madmen, remorseless as executioners," end quote. The fact is, they are placing the future of the human species at risk. The Harvard scientist James Anderson, who recently gave the Benton Lecture at the University of Chicago, he was awarded a prize and he came back to give a lecture. It was a selected audience only, and it happened that one of the instructors at the university also writes for Forbes, as he teaches journalism. And he put in a piece at Forbes, a short piece titled, "Carbon Pollution Has Shoved the Climate Back at Least 12 Million Years." Anderson goes on to warn that we have 5 years before we lose control of a human ability to address what is taking place.
It's very likely he's right, that we don't have that much time. So we have to link our immediate demands of various types on food and on jobs and on transportation and technology,
localism,
housing and healthcare. We need to link those to a revolutionary democratic vision and have an eco-socialist transitional program to end neoliberal alienation, empower the working class, and have ecologically based human development on the local, the collective, and the community, including more free time for people for its own sake, free time. So we have to have a class-conscious revolutionary program
that seems to be happening.
Yeah, that ends the oppression of women, of oppression of people of color, and has a balanced metabolism between society and nature. So It can be paid for, all the things we're demanding can be paid for, like full employment at living wages, guaranteed by the government, and involved in helping sound ecological programs, health care, education, culture. We can tax the rich, cut military spending, end corporate bailouts, stop corporate welfare done by a democratic and ecologically oriented state. We can, if we control this state, we can start agricultural programs. If you have agroecological programs, intensive agroecological programs, and such as no-till farming, you can.
But no-till, not based on petrochemicals, which is what Monsanto pushes.
That's right. What you do is you cut off the plant at its root. You leave the root in because that's where the carbon has been fixed in the soil. You plant. You add compost, and then you plant again. That's my own garden in my backyard. I get lots of food out of my backyard garden and my fruit trees, and it's all based on no chemicals, no fertilizers. It's based on worm composting, regular composting, and cutting off, leaving the roots in the ground instead of tilling with like regular farming. You're throwing the carbon into the environment. This way, you're pulling the carbon out. So if we have vast amounts of agroecological farming, we can reverse global warming. Now, it's going to take a massive amount, but that's what we have to do. That's one way. Of course, we're talking also solar power and wind power. All these things have to be done on a crash scale, a massive scale, and we have to be demanding that as a movement and as a people.
And that's exactly what James Anderson calls for, mobilization as if we were in a war. We are in a war for the life of humanity.
Exactly.
Marx analyzed, and others of his day analyzed, a contemporary, Marx, it dawned on me, he was a contemporary of Abraham Lincoln. Analyzed the fact that farming, industrial farming, which was being developed in Great Britain, was an extractive industry, just like taking coal out of the ground.
Yeah, exactly.
And that it depleted the nutrients as well as the carbon. And the micronutrients are essential for the well-being of the microbes that make the soil living, as well as for enable the organisms that consume the food to fully utilize it for their well-being.
That's right. Yeah, Marx was talking about this metabolism, right, that you have to have a balance. And he studied that, and among his other topics, he studied that in depth, and he was totally right.
It looks like I got to wrap up here. Somebody else is coming in. We're going to go out with People Have the Power. We've been talking with Lawrence Shoup, the historian, whose book, Wall Street's Think Tank, The Council on Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics, 1976 through 2014, lays bare the fact that the capitalist class, or at least the dominant members, have decided to protect their interests at the expense of all of human life, because of their limited understanding of the complexity of the natural order of the universe, the world itself, the living systems. They think that there'll be an adaptation to what is well underway. James Anderson says that we're shortly going to be ice-free in the Arctic, which means a destruction of the atmospheric system in the stratosphere that protects the ozone layer, which enables life in the mid-continent to function, especially the growing of plants. And that the destruction of the ocean accompanies that. And these are things that pictures in history books, imagining what it was like 5 million years ago, do not do justice to when human beings and higher order life are at play. So I want to
thank you for having me on.
I want to thank you so much for coming on to WZRD Chicago and encourage people to go to your website. I wanted to get more into eco-socialism, but they can find out more at your website. Can you give your website?
LawrenceShoup.org.
And
LaurenceShoup.org.
Okay. You're a perfect example of why people should study history. usually you hear, what can you do with that degree? You can save the planet, among other things, but I understand that you are working for yourself, enabling other people.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, I'm self-employed as a historian, yeah. But I'm semi-retired now. Actually, I'm working on a paperback edition of this book. I'm adding a chapter for this book, so it's going to be coming out in paperback. Right now, it's only hardback, Wall Street.
Okay. Thank you.
Right.
Thank you very much. This is WZRD Chicago.